picture two vastly different people, right? On one side of the city, you have like an elite corporate
Oh,
executive.
yeah. Corner office, seven-figure salary.
Exactly. Featured on the cover of business magazines and just fiercely protecting this pristine public image. But then on the complete opposite side of town, you have someone trapped in really severe, crippling drug addiction.
Someone completely isolated, desperate, and their life is just falling apart at the seams.
Right. And culturally, we view these two individuals as absolute polar opposites. I mean, we praise the executive, we put them on a pedestal, while we tend to pity or even stigmatize the addict.
But, you know, when you view them through a spiritual lens, they are actually in the exact same predicament. Both of them have traded their souls for something far less valuable than what they were designed for. I mean, both are making deals that are quietly destroying them from the inside out.
It just comes in very different packaging.
Exactly.
Well, welcome to the deep dive. If you're heading into your Connect group this week, you are exactly where you need to be.
Yeah, glad you're here with us.
Our mission today is to get you prepped, you know, primed and fully loaded with insights as a fellow member of our Harmony Christian Church family.
Because we are unpacking that incredibly heavy, challenging message from our returning guest speaker, Scott Taub.
Titled, The Wealth of Surrender: Discovering Freedom in Jesus.
Yeah, and it's been about a year since Scott was last with the Harmony family, and he brought a lot to the table this time.
He really did.
He didn't just offer these like abstract theological concepts, he brought profoundly practical, gritty realities about what it actually looks like to follow Jesus on a random Tuesday morning.
Right, when the worship music stops and real life hits.
Exactly.
And that is exactly what we wanted to distill for you today. We are going to take Scott's points, his parables, and those gripping stories he shared, and turn them into clear aha moments for you to bring to your small group.
To do that, we really have to start by completely tearing down and rebuilding how we define the word surrender.
Because the word surrender has terrible public relations in our modern culture, doesn't it? Oh, the word. I mean, we view it almost exclusively as a symbol of weakness.
Right, like waving a white flag.
Yeah, it implies your resources are entirely depleted, you've lost the battle, and you are forced to just raise your hands in defeat. It's seen as this reluctant, humiliating loss of personal autonomy.
But in the kingdom of God, that entire concept is inverted. Scott pointed out that giving up control isn't letting an enemy conquer you. It's actively placing your life into the hands of the one who already won the war.
That is such a huge shift.
You aren't losing, you know. You are stepping out of a war zone you were never equipped to survive in the first place, and you're stepping into actual, tangible freedom.
And to ground this in something concrete, Scott brought up those two parables from Matthew chapter 13.
Oh, these are great.
Yeah, so the first involves a man who just happens to stumble upon a hidden treasure in a field.
The imagery Scott painted for this was so vivid. He had us imagine this guy just taking a shortcut across a dirt field, minding his own business, when suddenly his foot sinks into a hole.
He reaches down into the dirt, feels an air pocket over an old wooden box, and pries it open to find hundreds of thousands of dollars in gold.
Just completely out of nowhere. And the companion story to that is the merchant who has spent his entire life actively hunting for one specific thing.
Right, the fine pearl.
Exactly. He isn't stumbling around blindly like the first guy. He is obsessed. I mean, he has traveled the world, exhausted all his resources, checking every single market, looking for this singular item.
Two completely different trajectories. The first guy trips over a fortune he wasn't even looking for. The second guy dedicates his entire existence to the search.
But they both hit the exact same conclusion, which is joyful surrender.
Yes.
The moment they realize the value of what they've found, they run off and liquidate everything they own. They sell their houses, their tools, their furniture, just to buy that field or that pearl.
And Scott shared that pretty funny daydream he used to have about this exact feeling, right? Back when he lived around here, he'd go for these 5-mile runs on Pine Point Beach in Scarborough, Maine.
Yeah, and he admitted that instead of using the time for deep contemplative prayer, like you might expect,
Right, like a good pastor should.
his mind would wander to that TV show to catch a smuggler.
I couldn't stop laughing at that. He would picture drug smugglers on a speedboat being chased by the Coast Guard, tossing these massive cellophane-wrapped bundles of cash overboard to destroy the evidence.
And in his daydream, one of those bundles just casually washes up on the sand right at his feet.
And he joked about wrapping the cash in his sweaty t-shirt, tossing it over his shoulder, and just sprinting back to his car as a multimillionaire.
Because he wouldn't care about the t-shirt he ruined or the run he didn't finish. The lesser things simply wouldn't matter anymore.
Okay, let's unpack this, because I actually want to push back on this analogy for a second.
Yeah, let's hear it.
If you find a box of gold or a washed-up bundle of cash, it is ridiculously easy to surrender, say, a beat-up three-year-old car or an old house with a cramped kitchen.
Oh, absolutely.
You know you're getting millions of dollars. You can go buy a brand new BMW in cash tomorrow. The math is simple. It's a no-brainer. But if the math of following Jesus is really that simple, why is spiritual surrender so agonizingly hard for us to do in real life?
What's fascinating here is how Scott approaches that exact tension. He introduces this concept of revelation-producing desire.
Revelation-producing desire.
Right. Look at the mechanics of it. Jesus doesn't operate by forcibly prying our fingers off the things we are desperately clinging to, because that just breeds resentment.
Yeah, nobody wants things taken from them.
Instead, he reveals the value of the kingdom. When you genuinely see how infinitely valuable the kingdom is, your grip on those lesser things naturally loosens.
So you drop the old car keys because you finally realize what you're being handed.
Precisely. I mean, the issue isn't that the math of surrender is wrong. The issue is that we have a severe lack of revelation. We just haven't fully realized the value of the treasure yet.
We secretly suspect that our cramped little kingdom, our current job, our bank account, our reputation is like the best we are ever going to get.
And if we fundamentally don't believe the treasure is worth it, we settle. We hold on to those lesser things. And Scott mapped out two massive traps on opposite ends of the human experience that keep us settling.
Let's go back to that corporate executive we talked about at the very beginning. Scott called this the trap of the elites.
Yeah, these are the individuals living entirely for money, prestige, and institutional power. And Scott framed this as taking Satan's deals, which are incredibly insidious because they are wrapped in these socially acceptable labels.
Right. We call it ambition or climbing the ladder or career advancement.
Society literally throws a parade for you when you take this deal.
They do. But the danger is that this deal quietly hollows out your soul, one promotion or one late night email at a time.
The modern echo of the exact deal Satan offered Jesus in the wilderness. Yeah. You offer Jesus all the kingdoms of the world in exchange for just bowing down.
But Jesus rejected it instantly because he already possessed a vastly superior kingdom. He didn't need to hustle for a lesser crown.
Right. Now, if the elites are blinded by success, the other trap is sheer desperation. And Scott shared a story here that absolutely took the air out of the room.
Oh, man. Yeah. This was intense.
It was about his daughter running into a man who attended East Point Church in South Portland, back where Scott used to be the pastor.
And the background of that story is just devastating. This man and his wife were caught in the incredibly dark, suffocating grip of severe addiction.
Scott quantified the state of their marriage by saying that on a scale of 1 to 10 of surviving, they were at a -3.
-3, wow. They
were simply existing in a house filled with anger, resentment, and profound disappointment Sunday after Sunday.
But the turning point came when the wife hit absolute rock bottom. I mean, she was at the point where she was ready to end her own life. She got down on her hands and knees and screamed out, "God, if you are really there, save me."
And Scott pointed out a crucial detail here. She was not bargaining. She wasn't saying, "God, if you fix my marriage, I'll go to church." It was a raw, unfiltered cry for a rescue mission.
And the response was immediate. God met her in that dark room with an overwhelming, tangible presence. It was described as a physical sensation of being wrapped in love.
And that single moment broke the chains of addiction and became the foundation for saving their marriage. They have been living in completely restored freedom for years now.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because I want you to take this thought into your connect groups. Think about the high-functioning corporate workaholic who neglects their family for power and the desperate addict who destroys their family for a substance.
We judge them so differently.
We do. But spiritually, they are identical. They are both trading the infinite treasure of God for a cheap, temporary substitute. And the wild part is, they both required the exact same rescue mission from Jesus.
Because the executive's corner office doesn't make them any less lost than the addict in the living room. If we connect this to the bigger picture, whether you are meticulously constructing a life of prestige or you are weeping on the floor begging for survival, that initial cry for help, that moment of salvation, is really just crossing the threshold. You've discovered the treasure.
But
as Scott heavily emphasized, the most difficult part of the Christian faith is what happens the very next morning.
The Tuesday morning reality check,
yep.
Worship music fades, the adrenaline of the rescue wears off, and the alarm clock goes off. How do you keep from drifting right back to your old coping mechanisms?
Right, because surrender is never a one-and-done event.
It is a daily, deliberate act of the will. It requires waking up and saying, "My life is yours today, Jesus," before your feet even touch the floorboards.
Because if you don't continually invest your attention in the treasure, human nature dictates that you will drift back to whatever made you feel safe before.
Whether that's a substance, a relationship, or, you know, spreadsheet.
Yeah. And Scott issued a pretty sharp critique of how local churches handle this. He noted that we have this tendency to create a spiritual assembly line.
Oh, the assembly line.
We see someone find the treasure and we immediately say, "Great, get baptized, join a small group, volunteer to park cars, and set up your 10% recurring giving."
We assume that if we just keep them busy, the joy will naturally sustain itself. But we completely bypass the hard work of cultivating their internal soul.
He used a very familiar metaphor for this, but applied it to our spiritual lives. The airplane oxygen mask.
I know. We've all heard the airplane oxygen mask speech 1,000 times in sermons and self-help podcasts. But stick with us because the mechanics of this are vital.
They really are. When the cabin pressure drops, you must secure your own mask before assisting a child or a stranger. Why? Because if you pass out from hypoxia, you are a liability to everyone around you.
Right.
In a spiritual context, cultivating your own soul by spending time with God isn't selfish. It is a basic mechanical requirement for survival.
Jesus explicitly taught this in John chapter 15 when he talked about abiding in the vine.
Right. If we, the branches, sever our connection to the main trunk, we don't just stop producing fruit.
Yeah.
We wither and die.
I want to push back on how this plays out in reality, though, because church culture implicitly teaches us the opposite of the oxygen mask, doesn't it?
Oh, for sure.
We are taught to put ourselves last. To serve until it hurts, to be the first one to arrive and the last one to leave. And I really want to challenge you as you discuss this in your Connect groups. Is that sense of church burnout you're feeling, that heavy exhaustion when you pull into the parking lot on a Sunday, actually a symptom of trying to breathe for everyone else while you are spiritually suffocating yourself?
Whoa.
Are you trying to pour out of a cup that has been bone dry for months?
This raises an important question, though. What does it actually look like to put the mask on? How do we abide in the vine mechanically?
Right. What's the practical step?
Scott used a brilliant kind of absurd analogy to explain how we shouldn't do it. He called it a Sunday-only marriage.
This was so funny.
He asked us to imagine if he treated his wife, Beth, the way the average Christian treats Jesus.
He said he'd go see Beth once a week, stand in front of her and sing a few songs for exactly 17 minutes, eat a tiny cracker with a thimble of unfermented grape juice, and then wave goodbye and say, "That was great. See you next week."
And then he added the statistical kicker. The average churchgoer only attends 1.3 times a month.
Oh, man.
So it's actually, "See you in a month, Beth."
Good luck with that marriage.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You cannot sustain a human marriage on an hour of interaction a month. And you certainly cannot sustain a vibrant, living faith on it. Sustenance requires daily, conversational intimacy.
He pointed to Philippians 4, which talks about presenting your request to God in every situation. It means keeping the dialogue open all day long.
And we are starving for that kind of connection. Mm-hmm. Scott dropped a statistic that I am still reeling from. He asked ChatGPT what percentage of people in the United States claim to have a relationship with an AI bot.
And the answer, 54% of people claim a relationship with an AI and 28% admit to being intimately or romantically involved with one.
It is a devastating reflection of our culture. People are opting for algorithms because real human relationships are messy, demanding, and they often end in heartbreak.
Right.
Isolation just feels safer.
But Scott's point is that a relationship with Jesus, when placed at the center of your life, will never fail or betray you. But it requires actually sitting down at the table with him to build that trust.
Pulling up a chair to get real nourishment. Mm. In Matthew 4, when Satan tempts a starving Jesus to turn stones into bread, Jesus replies that mankind doesn't live on bread alone, but on every word from the mouth of God.
That is the oxygen. That is the food. And Scott gave us the exact mechanical tool he uses to eat this food. For the last 7 months, he's been using the Beatitudes.
Those are the blessings Jesus lists in Matthew 5, right? Like, blessed are the poor in spirit or blessed are the peacemakers.
Yeah, exactly. But what's crucial is how Scott uses them. He doesn't just read them quickly and close his Bible. He uses them as a daily treasure map.
He memorized them.
He recites them back to Jesus in prayer to intentionally align his mind with God's definition of the good life. When he feels the urge to aggressively defend himself in a conflict, he recites, "Blessed are the meek." He uses the text mechanically to rewire his daily reactions and cool his temper.
Okay, let's say you are doing the daily work.
Yeah.
You are putting the oxygen mask on. You are at the table reciting the Beatitudes. What is the actual payoff? Does your life actually look any different on a Tuesday afternoon? Or are you just gritting your teeth and waiting to die so you can go to heaven?
That is the ultimate question. And Scott made sure to clarify that the reward of surrender is not just a get-out-of-hell-free card or a shiny new immortal body in the afterlife.
Though he did have a pretty sunny joke about that. He mentioned how futile it is when a 75-year-old spends a small fortune on cosmetic procedures to look younger.
Because ultimately, you just end up being a 75-year-old who has a lot less money. The physical body is temporary no matter what we do.
Right. So the real reward is what Scott termed now freedoms. These are profound psychological and spiritual liberations that you get to experience in your everyday life right now.
And he categorized them into two groups, freedoms from and freedoms to.
The catalog of freedoms from was a massive paradigm shift. First, freedom from the exhausting bargaining relationship with God.
Oh, we all know exactly what this sounds like. God, if you make sure this house deal goes through, I promise I'll start giving 10%.
Or, God, if you heal this illness, I'll never miss a Sunday.
When you surrender, you stop treating the creator of the universe like a vending machine you have to negotiate with.
He also highlighted freedom from self-defense. Think about the physiological toll of constantly needing to protect your ego. When someone criticizes you in a meeting, your heart rate spikes, and your brain immediately starts drafting a defense attorney's opening statement to prove you're right.
But when you realize Jesus has already secured your identity, you don't have to defend it anymore. The need to control outcomes, the need to manipulate situations so you feel secure, it all evaporates.
He mentioned freedom from having your identity tangled up in your job title or your net worth, and ultimately freedom from shame.
How he described the freedom from shame was incredibly moving. He said that because of our past failures, we often approach God like a defeated dog with our heads hanging down in disgrace.
But the grace of Jesus is so absolute that he doesn't just forgive the sin. Conceptually, he places his hand under our chin and gently lifts our head.
He elevates our gaze so we can walk through life face to face, eye to eye with him, carrying zero condemnation.
And because of that lifted gaze, we get the freedoms too. We have the freedom to actually wait patiently on God's timing instead of kicking doors open out of panic.
We have the freedom to respond to hostility with grace instead of just reacting out of our own triggered insecurities.
And we have the freedom to be wildly generous with our time and our money because we aren't terrified of running out. It fundamentally changes your operating system.
So what does this all mean? When I try to synthesize this whole catalog of freedoms, I picture how most of us walk through life before surrender. Imagine you are hiking up a mountain and you are wearing a 90-pound backpack.
Okay, I can picture that. Heavy.
Very heavy. Inside that backpack are all the stressful PR strategies you've drafted to make people think you have your life together. It's full of all the legal contracts you are trying to force God to sign so you feel safe. It is exhausting.
Yeah, that's a heavy load.
Surrender is not losing the hike. Surrender is finally unbuckling that crushing backpack and letting it drop into the dirt, that dropping sensation. That is the true definition of rest.
That visual captures it perfectly. When you look at Scott's entire message through that lens, you realize he is changing the core question of the Christian faith. For so long, we approach God with this sense of dread, asking, what do I have to give up to follow Jesus?
Like we are losing out on something fun.
Right. But once the revelation hits and you see the immense value of dropping the backpack, the question transforms. The empowered question becomes, what am I holding on to that is keeping me from receiving this treasure?
Because whatever you are holding on to, Jesus is infinitely better.
Amen.
All right, Harmony family, you are officially prepped and primed. You are armed with a new definition of surrender. You understand the traps of corporate ambition and sheer desperation. You know why you must secure your own spiritual oxygen mask first, and you understand the mechanics of those profound now freedoms waiting for you today.
Your connect groups are going to spark some deeply necessary conversations this week. I'm sure of it.
But before you head into those groups, I want to leave you with one final perspective-altering question to chew on.
Ooh, let's hear it.
Throughout this deep dive, we've looked at the parables, assuming that we are the ones who stumble into the field. We assume we are the merchants who have to give up everything we own to purchase Jesus, the ultimate treasure.
Because that is how we naturally read ourselves into the text.
Exactly. But what if you flip the perspective entirely? What if you are the treasure hidden in that dirt field? What if you are the pearl of great price? And Jesus is the one who joyfully gave up absolutely everything, leaving the perfection of heaven, enduring the agony of the cross, giving up his very life just to purchase you.
Wow. When you realize your own value in his eyes, everything shifts.
It changes the entire equation. Because when you realize the king of the universe has already raised a white flag out of love for you, surrendering your own life doesn't feel like a humiliating defeat anymore. It just feels like coming home. Have an amazing time in your connect groups. We will catch you on the next deep dive.